The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order state and local government operations, reforms, technology, and elections. Representative Mullery, your bill is House File 1395. I'm going to move that House File 1395 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice. And we don't have a quorum yet, but the motion's before us and the bill is before us. So, Representative Mullery, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Basically, this deals with use deeds that result from tax forfeited lands. And the statutes are really quite a mess right now and don't conform to the way reality is out there right now. And so, this is many decades old that it hasn't been reformed. So they've been working on it, I believe, 4 years, working with all of the interested parties and come up with a provision. Right now, the when the tax deed goes out, it can either go out for value or it can go out for free under a specific public use. And the department feels that, and I totally agree with them, Department of Revenue is not supposed to be doing land use examination. And there's been questions such as, is a park use a place to dump gravel, things like that. And so we need to clear this up and also clear up the reverter so that it complies with the rest of the law, according to the Bar Association. And with that, this morning we have Mr. Nord from the Department of Revenue to explain in detail.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason Nord, and I work in the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I believe you have a number of handouts on the issue, and this is kind of a complex issue that can take a lot of time, and I assume you do not want me to take a lot of time to go through the whole issue. I'll try and summarize in just a couple of minutes. But this is an issue that the department has worked on for about 3 or 4 years, and we've met with a lot of the stakeholders involved, a long list of stakeholders, including the realtors, the Bar Association, the Landowners Association, the county groups, the city groups, a lot of individual cities, some of the economic development people, and so on. And so it's been a pretty well-vetted proposal that I think everybody is pretty comfortable with. And as Representative Mullery mentioned, this is a 1941 law that hasn't changed significantly since 1941, where essentially the only options for a local government to acquire tax forfeited land is either to pay full price or get it free on a contingent deed that reverts back to the state of Minnesota if they don't ever follow the authorized use for which the deed is tied to. And we've had a lot of issues pop up and some lawsuits pop up where we are trying to enforce compliance with the use deed. And we believe that there are a lot of title problems out there where people aren't really aware that they have a use contingent deed and they're putting parcels to use and it's causing a lot of problem. So maybe the one handout that I could focus in on by way of summary is there's a one-page chart that kind of summarizes some of the problems with current law structure and what some of our proposed solutions are for that. The first big problem with use deeds is that there's an infinite contingency. In perpetuity, this reversionary clause is in place. If we issued a deed in 1950, we're still supposed to be monitoring whether or not the city's in compliance with that deed. And if they go out of compliance with that deed, we're supposed to revert it back to the state. We've put a 30-year expiration on that reverter, and we've put in some provisions that allow use deeds that are in compliance to be exchanged for quitclaim deeds. Another big problem is the lack of clarity as to what use deeds should be issued for, what the authorized public uses are. We've tried to provide some contextual definition to identify the types of uses that are eligible, and we've actually enumerated a list of uses for which a use deed can be issued. So for roads, parks, trails, transitways, beaches, public parking, civic and recreation facilities, and public service facilities like fire halls and police stations. We've also had a court ruling that has left us with a troubling precedential decision that has said that a park is defined, since park isn't defined in state law, it can be defined in a city's code or a city's charter. And so we would have to look city by city how their code or how their charter defines a park before we can determine whether they're in compliance with a park use or not. And so we're providing some parameters to better define parks as they relate to use deeds. There's also really a lack of alternatives. This free, all full price or free, is creating an incentive for abuse. And so we're creating some other alternatives to deal with unique situations. So the free options under our proposal not only include use deeds for the more limited uses, but they also include the conveyance of dedicated developer outlots that failed to get transferred, or similar properties in common interest communities that failed to get transferred prior to forfeiture. But we've also created some reduced price options, some opportunities for local governments to purchase these lands for less than market value, either to correct blight, to develop affordable housing, or to preserve wetland and to manage drainage and storage of stormwater, or to preserve land in its natural state, or for a lot of these little tiny sliver parcels that end up forfeiting that the counties want to get back on the tax rolls, but they can't even sell them for what they're supposedly worth. And so we're giving them the opportunity to try and sell those at a less than market value. And then the full price option remains for local governments to purchase it at full market value for any public purpose. There's also a number of other technical issues that we're addressing. The classification procedure of tax forfeited lands has kind of been a confusing process. It's worked well for some counties and not so much for others, where there's been stalemates when the cities don't agree with the county's classification. So we've created a new process that enables counties to overcome those stalemates. We've also had problems where cities can put a hold on lands from being sold to the public, and they can continually renew that hold. And so we are putting a limit on that holding process and dealing with a number of other miscellaneous issues that I'd be happy to answer any questions about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a quorum, and I'm going to withdraw my motion on the Mullery bill because it's a division report. Representative Nelson.
I'd like to move the division report.
Representative Nelson moves the division report. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then I'll renew my motion on, or I'll just do a new motion on House File 1395, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. And now we're in proper form. And all of these are, I believe, division reports. So we'll have Representative Nelson move that first. Representative Kiffmeyer, are you first on the list?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I don't keep the list.
Okay.
But thank you for calling on me.
I try to, but sometimes it's confusing.
Mr. Chairman, you do a very good job.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to hinder the presentation process of this particular bill. I have a question, but
sure,
it can wait until they're done presenting.
All right. Mr. Nord, do you have more to present? Or
Mr. Chair, I think I'm finished.
All right. Well, Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there's already a Chapter 469 exception, which does create confusion also.
So, Representative Kiffmeyer, why don't you ask your question?
Okay. This was just an informational question in regards to, you had mentioned the stakeholders, and you had listed a landowner association of some sort. So I was just wondering what the name of that association was. Was there more than one?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nard,
Representative Kiffmeyer, I believe it was the Cabin Owners Association that I mentioned. I actually was trying to remember the exact name of their association, but the group.
Ms. Pro.
All right, Mr. Representative Kiffmeyer, does that answer your question?
Well, no, Mr. Chairman. Well, it does answer part of the question. So the Cabin Owners was the only. Is there any other association? I mean, I get concerned sometimes when we have a lot of government entities working on some of these bills, and yet the landowners, private property landowners, maybe you have additional information how they were included in this.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I tried to find one, and they were the only, we all know who, I don't know their exact title, but we all know, I think it's seasonal recreational owners or whatever it is. But I contacted the four sections of the Bar Association that I thought might represent owners of properties. I asked around to find out if there is any general property owners group, and I couldn't find one.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question. Thank you.
Okay, further discussion to the bill. And Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the joint committee that the joint hearing that Representative Nelson and Chair Nelson and Chair Mullery had a while ago, as well as in our committee in our division recently, it's become clear that as we're facing still $1 billion shortfall this year and nearly $6 billion shortfall in the next 2 years, that there are some things that governments aren't going to be able to afford to be able to do. The lack of clarity of the authorized public use related to the use deed is an important issue and needs to be dealt with. But as I understand it, we're spending a lot of time litigating lack of clarity for about 7,700 parcels around the entire state, of which there may be a few dozen every year. We have the Department of Revenue, the Attorney General's Office, we have cities and counties involved in litigation. The stakeholders have done a very good job of providing some clarity to the definitions and other pieces. And I actually think that if they, in a more prosperous time, that the 16-page bill we have before us may be a, good move. But we're going to have to make some really difficult decisions about leaving people without health care, about cutting state aid to local governments. And we're considering a 16-page bill that's going to continue a process that has resulted in a lot of litigation between governments. I think there is a better way to do it. And so it's with great respect for the people who have worked extremely hard on this bill, and knowing that not having a bill move forward is not an option, that we have to provide that clarity and have to do something moving forward. I do have a recommendation to delete some sections, an amendment to delete some sections of the bill, and I believe Mr. Malander and Ms. Dyson has that.
All right. Representative Kalin moves an amendment, and I think Ms. Dyson has the amendment. So, Ms. Dyson, to the Kalin amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, the Kalin amendment is where he moves to delete sections 1, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, and 13.
Why don't you do that one more time slowly so we know what's left in the bill? It might be easier, I don't know, to do what's left or to, but go ahead one more time.
Okay. The motion is to delete sections 1, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, and 13.
All right. Does everyone on the committee understand what's being deleted? Everyone appears to. So, Representative Mullery, your opinion on that amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson and I asked that it not be passed last year. It started last year, and because we didn't have time to hear it in our committees last year, we prevailed on the Tax Committee chair in the House not to hear it and put it in the bill. The Senate had heard it all through all the committees. We worked on it. We decided to have a joint hearing of the two committees right away, the very first hearing date for our committees. And I never heard, we asked that we be told within a week of ideas. We waited a month to put it back on at this point to come in and try and basically got a bill that has taken incredible amount of time. That I think it's 4 years the department's been working on this to get every buy-in from everyone around. Obviously, we cannot get buy-ins on an enormous change like that in a short time, so I would strongly oppose it. I assume the department.
Mr. Nard?
For the department.
Mr. Pawlowski, yeah, it would be I think it would be quite unfortunate to lose those parts of the bill. There are a number of important processes that that would fall by the wayside. The clarification of the whole classification process would continue to go back to a situation where counties and cities reach a a lack of agreement, and the taking out Section 5 would be particularly a problem because it would leave the Chapter 469 loophole in place. So what that loophole does is it basically says if you ask for a parcel on a use deed for a park, we give you a deed that says you have to put it to use as a park, and if you ever don't put it to use as a park, we revert it back to the state. What this loophole says is if you sell it for economic development purposes under Chapter 469, that's not an abandonment of the park use. So we can't revert the parcel back to the state. And so it's one of the biggest problems with use deeds that's out there. So if we take that section out of the bill, I think the portion of that section that Representative Kalin might be the most interested in is our tactic for dealing with the backload of deeds that we have. When we're taking the 30-year, we're putting a 30-year sunset on the reversionary clause so that we don't have to deal with these deeds in perpetuity. But we're saying that that expiration clause cannot expire before the year 2015. And our rationale is to give 5 years for the counties to identify parcels that they want to pursue compliance on before that reversionary clause just expires. And I think Representative Kalin has interest in figuring out a better way to deal maybe with the backlog of deeds that are out there so that perhaps we can avoid some litigation. So far, we've only had one complete major lawsuit on it in recent years, but we're on the brink of maybe a couple more cases that could occur. And it's possible in the next 5 years, if counties pursue compliance on some of these parcels, that there could be a few more lawsuits. So I understand Representative Kalin's motivation, but I would argue that we could easily adopt this bill and readdress that issue next session. From the department's perspective, it would be a shame to lose so much of our hard work to try to deal with an issue that I think we could come back to next year. It was the counties actually that had asked us to delay that to 2015. We originally had 2012 as the sunset date. They asked us to push it back because of budget considerations to give them more time to look at these properties. And so I'd be happy to work with Representative Kalin over the interim to come up with better ideas for next year, but it would be a real shame to lose all the hard work that we've done on this for the past few years.
Representative Nelson, was this amendment offered in the division?
Mr. Chair, no, it was not. In division, the motion was to lay it over, which with the time frame of the deadlines that we probably would not get it passed.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin, to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did make the motion in the division to lay the bill on the table because I know that wanting to respect the process that you've laid out very clearly for this committee, wanting to have issues worked out in division, and my understanding is that the provision was passed by the Senate not as a standalone bill, but as part of the omnibus of an omnibus bill last year, and so the bill could have proceeded. So I wanted the background for you, Mr. Chair, as well as for this committee, to know that I think that there's more work to be done on this bill. I think that my amendment gets us closer to something that does what has to be done, but not what others want to be done, but is not absolutely urgent. And so I ask members to support my amendment. The easy thing would be to just pass the bill along. The tougher thing is to be able to say no and to make some savings when we need to. And by removing the unnecessary portions of this bill, I think we're making that statement and working together to help our cities, counties, and state not do the things that we don't need to be doing.
Mr. Nard?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cannon, I'm not sure that the change would actually yield savings. I'm afraid that without these changes, we could actually end up with more lawsuits because the department in a vacuum would have to step up with some policies and procedures, and without having the benefit of legislative intent and a new law, we would have to make some decisions about our policies. And I'm quite sure that it's not a guarantee that we would save any money by taking out these sections.
All right. Further discussion to the amendment. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor of the Kalin Amendment, please raise your hand. All those opposed. All right. Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, that's the end of the presentation unless there's further questions.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, you know I brought this up in division as a concern, asked for clarification, didn't receive any good clarification. Members, I'm going to move to amend the bill on line 1.25, delete the new language, reinstate the old language, and on line 2.1, delete the new language, and then renumber that clause accordingly. Members, I asked in committee here in division, you know, what how this sentence works here. If you look up in line 1.21, it says the classification furthermore must. Right, that's a very definitive statement. And then if you look at the new language in 1.25, protect and sustain important environmental and ecological systems. Members, I asked in committee, what is an important natural, important environmental and ecological system? I got no answer. I tried the converse then. Said, okay, well, what's an unimportant ecological system? Again, I got no answer. The response from the author of the bill and in my follow-up discussion with the agency is that this was a clause that the Senate wanted put in. This was not a piece that was discussed with all the stakeholders. It was not a part of the large group getting together to come to consensus. This was something that the Senate thought was a good thing to have. Well, members, coming from a county that has had rapid growth, as our municipalities and counties are looking at putting in transportation systems, it seems like every time we turn around and you got a little depression of land that may hold water once every 6 years when we get a 5-inch rain, that's now that depression has become a sacred fen, for goodness sakes. All right, the cost and the burden on our local units of government in trying to make sound decisions, it's incredible. All right, as you look at this, we've got a sentence here that is very, very ill-defined. All right, we have a sentence here, though, that can be grabbed on by any organization to slow down and impede progress simply because of the way it's ill-defined. Members, I hope you can support my amendment.
So any discussion to the amendment? Would there like to be a comment?
Madam Chair, Mueller. My understanding is I believe he wants to take out is protect and sustain important environmental and ecological systems. Is that?
That is correct.
I've talked to the department, I believe, has no position with regard to that, so I would take the same position. It was something that the Senate wanted, and we don't particularly care.
All right. Any further questions or discussion? All right. The motion before us is on line 1.25 and line 2.1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
No.
I think the motion did not prevail. Division's been called, so all those in favor, raise your hand. And those opposed, raise your hand. I stand corrected. The motion does prevail. The amendment is passed. All right. Now, is there any other discussion or any other amendments that we have before us? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller, I apologize because I'm not sure if there are testifiers, say, from the counties, for example. Have the counties weighed in on what they think of the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, the counties have weighed in for about 4 years on working on this, as have the cities. I see the representative from my county up there who had some changes because they had different procedures. So My understanding, we did add in the Representative Nelson's committee, we added some language for the cities, so to they're okay. I don't really know of anybody that, of all of the many players in this, I have not heard from anybody that.
I believe we have someone else at the table who would like to identify himself and maybe comment on that question.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and Representative Mullery is correct. We've been working on this for a number of years. We're fully supportive, okay. And our folks are very happy their concerns have been addressed over those years, so thank you.
Does that answer your questions? Okay, any other questions? I believe we're ready to move on the bill as amended, and this, I guess it was, it will be moved to civil justice. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed to civil justice.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, would you be ready to present your bill? And I believe Representative Kahn will be moving House File 2557 as recommended to pass and be referred to Finance Committee. Representative Kahn, to your bill.
Yes. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to move that House File 2557 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. And then I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, the A1 amendment, which should be in your packet.
Is it? And the A1 amendment is partially adds the make sure that we've referenced the accessibility standards, and I do have Mary Hartman here if anyone needs any discussion on that we've passed, that we did pass, and the rules that have been developed on those earlier. And then it also puts in some language on the standards for transparency. We do have a representative from OET who is the promulgator of the bill.
Would like to speak on the amendment then, the A1 amendment, or should we, otherwise we'll take care of that first.
I'd like to just take care of the amendment,
okay.
Put the bill in the shape, and then speak
all right.
on the bill.
Is there any further discussion or questions regarding the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is now in the form that you'd like it, so
okay.
You can.
I think this is just part of the program that I've had for a long time to get a more uniform system of information management in the state and to try and get rid of duplications that we have with things being done in separate departments, so that departments will be able to do the kind of refining they need, but we'll start with a basic thing like the creation of webs.
All right. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Michael Meilenberg. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Office of Enterprise Technology. OET is the state's lead agency for providing information technology services to government entities. Transparency, which this bill deals with, as well as the webmaster section, are very important issues to us. The federal government has taken a lead role on transparency issues, and the states are now trying to figure out an appropriate path as well. In Minnesota, we've made some good initial first steps with the creation of Transparency and Accountability Project for Minnesota, also known as TAP Minnesota, as well as recovery.mn, the state of Minnesota's official website for coordination and implementation of the stimulus package. The Office of Enterprise Technology strongly supports the goals of this bill, and we are willing to work with all parties involved to make sure that we have a package that is implementable. We would just caution a couple things, though. One is that it should be pointed out that due to the decentralized nature of data collection in Minnesota, that it may make a challenging situation to implement and enforce. We do feel that we can work through that, though. We would also like to point out that this is a very complicated activity, and it will require very careful, deliberate, and thoughtful processes to make sure that we aren't exposing anything but public data. Most importantly, even though this is a policy committee, we would like to point out that although we strongly support the bill, there would be resources needed in order to satisfy its requirements and to implement it. There's a fiscal note that is in development currently, and we expect that you will have that in a couple days.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, do you have any other testifiers, Representative Kahn?
No, I don't think so. I'd like the bill to pass as it is now.
Okay. So we have the bill before us, and it has been amended with the A1 amendments, and you would renew your motion to pass the bill as amended and send it to Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
No.
The bill is passed as amended. Now I believe we'll go to Representative Thiessen. This is House File 2922. Okay. And I would move House File 2922 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. And Representative Thiessen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we move the A4 amendment as well?
You have an A4A or A4 amendment. I will so move the amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The bill has been amended. Now you may go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, for the past several years, the legislature has been making some significant progress on reforming our entire pension system to make it more stable, first of all, and making it more stable really with the goal to keeping our promises to public employees in this state and maintaining our contractual obligation to those employees as well. And you'll see later on this session a larger bill that includes additional work that does that for all of our statewide funds. And so we are making significant progress on making sure that all of our statewide funds are stable. The bill today that's before you is one piece of that process, which is for the MRF Fund, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. And I just want to give a little background on who we're talking about, first of all. It is about 4,500 Minnesotans who worked for the City of Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Schools, for the Metropolitan Airports Commission, for MNSCU, for Hennepin County, for the Metropolitan Council, and also their spouses, their widows or widowers. Most of these members, the vast majority of these members, are already retired. They live in nearly every legislative district in the state, and their average benefit is about $2,700 per month. It's less for the widows and widowers. And really, one thing I want to say that's very important is this is the only benefit they receive. So these folks do not get Social Security. They're not entitled to Social Security because they were not coordinated with Social Security at the time that they worked. So MRF is the only benefit, the only retirement benefit that they get. And because they're not linked to Social Security, they actually paid a higher contribution every year than most public employees pay. As a percentage of their income. So they paid, I think, 9.85%?
9.75%
of their salary towards their pension. And that's another important point to remember, is that this is a contract that we established with them, and the legislature is the one that governs every pension. We set the benefits, we set the payout amounts, we set all the rules for these pensions, and the pensions just administer those rules. So that's kind of where we are. So the concern here is that this pension is in danger, and I want to talk a little bit about that problem a little bit. MRF is a closed fund since 1979, and most of you, I think, know what that means, but basically it means since 1979 no new members have entered MRF. They've all gone into the PARA fund, our statewide public employee fund. And that 1979 was also a decision that the state of Minnesota made. So in a typical fund that's not closed, you know, the source of money for the benefits comes in both from the employer and the employee contributions and from investment earnings. Those are kind of the two streams of money. But in a mature closed fund like MRF, the only major source of earnings, because there's very few active employees who are making money who can pay those contributions in, are the investment returns. I want to talk about investment returns just briefly. They have been on par over the last several decades with other funds and with the State Board of Investment. So, those funds are now being managed and have been for several years by the State Board of Investment. Before the market turned down, it was at 92% funding, which was on par or better than most of our funds. I want to emphasize that this problem has not been a problem of mismanagement of investments when you compare it to any other fund in the state, and I think that's an important point for us to keep in mind. But we are caught, this fund is caught in an irreversible downward cycle. It has a life of about 5 to 10 years left, and just to explain that, you know, there's about $860 million in assets in the fund. The payments out are about $150 million per year. So just to break even, this fund on its investments, the investments on $860 million have to be $150 million a year, which is just over 17% year gain every year forever. Right? Well, not forever, but until the fund expires. The likelihood of making 17% a year for every year going forward is, you know, highly unlikely. You know, it would be great if that happened for all of us, I suppose, but highly unlikely. So if we make less than that, the benefit payments start to reduce the principal. So not only are they having to pay out more than they're making, but the amount of money that they're investing and can make money on shrinks, right? And so, for instance, if they only made 10% this year, they'd have to pay out, that would be about $86 million on that $860 million total assets. They have to get to the 150 that they have to pay out, they're taking $54 million out of their principal base. So that reduces that principal base to what, about $800 million, which means they have to make even more money the next year to make up for that loss. So this really is in a downward cycle. As I said, the life is going to be 5 to 10 years, that's what the actuaries, before they don't have money to pay out to cover the cost of these pensions. Another significant point to keep in mind is that waiting, every year that we wait, it just gets more expensive to fix this problem. And when you're dealing with pensions, and we've learned this over and over again, the longer you wait, the worse it is. So just a couple more details about how we have worked this in the past in terms of the money flowing into the fund. So very few employer-employee contributions because there's very few active working people. Investment earnings, as you know, over the last several years have been a bad situation for all of our funds and for all of us. That has really diminished the amount of money going into the fund. There are some other sources of revenue, though, that the state has decided to put into this fund over time. There is a little extra kick that the employers put in of about $4 million a year, approximately, every year, above their typical contribution. After that, the state has put in a stream of funding ever since the fund was closed. So in 1979, it covered all contributions above, you know, to make up what was needed. In 1991, that was capped at a level about $13 million, and it's been reduced now to $9 million a year. And then the employers have an obligation, the employers being the, you know, the city and the Airports Commission, the Met Council, maybe not the Met Council actually, but the other employers, have an obligation to put in the excess, except that, and this is another one of the reasons that we created as a legislature that caused a problem. The way that the statute defines what that excess is to kind of create this fiction that the amount in the fund is equal to the amount to cover benefit liabilities. So we just said in statute, we're going to just assume that the amount in the fund, regardless of what the market's doing, regardless of anything, is equal to what we need. And so when they did the accounting, money wasn't coming in to the fund because even though at a market value basis it was very short, we as a legislature said, well, we're going to pretend that that's not the case. And so the accountants wouldn't call on these other employers to put money into the fund. Now, that's been fixed. You know, this is one of the things we fixed over the last several years, except for this fund, in all of our other funds. But the point is that the Minnesota legislature, all of us sitting around, have set the benefits and the funding mechanisms going forward. In past years, the percentages in terms of making up the difference have been about 55% of the excess has been paid by the state, about 45% has been paid by the local employers. And in this bill, what we're trying to do is set, you know, that ratio in place going forward. So the solution that we've come up with is to create a funding mechanism to cover these benefits going forward. It is an administrative consolidation, which means that we're moving MRF into PARA, but it's in a separate fund. And this is another thing I want to emphasize. PARA and its members and its beneficiaries are not and will not be liable for making up any of the shortfalls, any of the losses in this fund. We're keeping it in a separate account. There's going to be separate accounting until such time as it gets to, I think, 80% funded under the bill now, which would match where PARA is today. And then at that point, they'll grow or fall together. But it's very important that PARA and its members are not doing anything to make up the difference in this fund. There will be an eventual merger, as I said, when we reach this parity level. MRF members are going to be covered by PARA rules in terms of benefits paid. So they are actually, you know, we have different, you know, percentages of payouts and increases in benefits year to year for all of our different funds. PARA is going to be reduced, the MRF members are going to be reducing their benefit payout to match PARA going forward. So they're actually giving up quite a bit of what, you know, was promised to them. So they're paying in their share as well. So we're creating this fund. It's going to ultimately merge once we get to parity. The benefits are going to match PARA's benefits going forward. And then we're asking for the local governments, the local employers, and the state to put in some additional funding to make up the funding shortfall and to keep our promises to these MRF members, to keep our contractual promises. And, you know, again, these folks, this is the only pension benefit that they get. They don't get Social Security. If they lose this benefit, they're going to be coming back to us being on our public programs, basically. I mean, that's the reality of where we are right now. I mean, these about 20% are widows or widowers, about 80 years old. The average age is actually fairly high for this fund. You know, the bottom line, the reason for this bill is we need to keep our promise to these MRF members, and we've come up with what I think is a fairly equitable solution that does it over time. It's not an easy ask, and I'm not going to say that I'm not going to try to pretend that it's not, especially in the budget times we face. But MRF members are giving up a significant portion of their benefit that accounts that adds up to tens of millions of dollars over the course of this over the course of the life of this fund. The employers are kicking in a substantial amount of money, and then the state would kick in a substantial amount of its money as well. I think that the issue here is that there's obligations to go around, and with that, I guess I will leave it for questions.
All right, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we understand the situation Minneapolis is in, and it is a tough one for the MRF retirees. We have the same problem in a lot of retirement funds around the state. And one concern I've heard about this bill is we are asking state taxpayers, many of whom are now on defined contribution plans themselves, or unemployed or underemployed, struggling to get by. They have no guarantee that their plan is going to perform well or not well in the stock market. But we're continuing here a defined benefit program. I know you said they are giving up something, and I acknowledge that. But we're asking the state taxpayers throughout Minnesota to bail out Minneapolis. So one question would be, why are we doing that, given the situations that they face and other pension plans face? And then why aren't we trying to solve more of these pension programs on an equal footing rather than just doing Minneapolis?
Representative Thiessen.
Well, I wish you'd have been here at the beginning of my remarks, Representative Gottwald, because I talked about some of those things, but I can go over it again. The first point that I would make is that having a discussion about defined benefit versus defined contribution plans in terms of fixing this problem is kind of beside the point, because we can't change. We have a contractual obligation going forward. If you want to talk about changing how we do benefit, how we structure our things going forward for new employees, you know, we can have that discussion. But right now, this is a defined benefit plan. When these folks entered their employment, entered this contract with the state and with their employers, it was a defined benefit plan. And so I don't think we should get distracted by that discussion. The second thing is we're doing a tremendous amount as this year, as we have over the last several years in the Pension Commission, to actually do a lot of reform in our pensions and have actually made great progress on that. So why the state of Minnesota here? I mean, I think that's the more central question and a fair one. A couple of things that I would say to that. The first is the state of Minnesota, this state legislature, is the party that sets the rules for pensions. So we have set the benefits. So if we think the benefits have been too high, we should look in the mirror. If we think that the way that this funding mechanism is set, we should look in the mirror, because it's all statutorily defined. So that is where the ultimate responsibility lies. The second thing is there is a legal obligation that the state is going to have on its back. If this fund goes bankrupt, there will be lawsuits, and there is a strong claim against the state of Minnesota that because we've set the rules, because we didn't fund this and set up a funding mechanism that's accurate, we are breaching a contract. And these have been considered by Minnesota state courts to be contracts that are enforceable like a contract, or a promissory estoppel theory, I suppose, more technically, but that's essentially a contract. So there will be liability coming back to the state that we will have to sort out or pay out, right? These are folks that live all across the state. So, you know, although they were Minneapolis employees, in almost every legislative district there are MRF members. And if we don't do this, because they're not in Social Security, we're going to be paying for this anyway. I mean, what I'd like to do is actually have a situation where people are getting the money in and they can actually take care of themselves instead of coming to the state for nursing home care, health care benefits, or all those kind of things. So that's kind of the legal piece of it. There's, and if we breach this contract, we're also breaching the contracts clause of the Constitution. You know, we'd be impairing a contract. Now, there's legal liabilities on the employer's part, too, the city and all those folks, too. And so it's not just going to be the state, but there is a state obligation obligation here. And I guess the last thing I'd say is that I think we also need to think about the fact that there is these are, you know, public employees that have served not just people in Minneapolis, but served everybody that's ever visited Minneapolis. So the fact that you go to Minneapolis and use its roads, that you go to Minneapolis to go downtown, I mean, do all those kind of things, that wouldn't happen without these, you know, without these employees, and Minneapolis serves a lot of the state. So I think there's lots of reasons that both legal, kind of political or moral reasons that we should step forward. We're asking for shared sacrifice for everybody. And to your last point, I guess, which is there's a lot of people who are in tough shape right now, and I absolutely agree with that as well. The difference, I think, is that we have actually made promises to these folks directly, you know, because they're public employees, they signed contracts, they created a contractual relationship, but we also made promises in kind of a larger sense to them that as they did the work of the public and served the public, one of the benefits that they would receive, you know, they probably did receive a lower salary that they could have gotten in the private sector, but these are the rules we set up, and I think we should honor those promises.
Okay. Representative Atwalt, did you have something to follow
up? Just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair. I appreciate the answers, Representative Thiessen. I just, you know, we're running into this over and over again with so many pension plans, and MRF is a big one. I agree with Representative Thiessen. We need to keep our commitments, but hindsight is 2020. You're right, Representative Thiessen. It would be nice to have done things differently in the past, but when Minnesota's hurting this much, we've got so many pensions to fix. It's tough kind of picking winners and losers, if you will, and I realize we've got to keep our commitment, but we've got more of these to go. This is not the last one, and we've got to try to look for some long-term solutions here.
Yeah. Representative Thiessen.
I think we actually are getting to close to saying this is the last one of its type. We're getting close to that. There's a few closed funds like this that we are working on, but, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, I think we've actually made great progress in this state on reforming our pension program, and this is just one more step. It's the only one that, you know, needs immediate money at this time. You'll see another bill, as I said before, coming forward that Mary Murphy, Representative Murphy, will be carrying that deals with the pension liabilities in TRA and in PARA and in MSRS. I do want to, you know, make very clear that the Minneapolis taxpayers are going to pay an additional $16 to $20 million a year. I mean, so it's a significant, especially in these times like all of us are facing, that will go toward this MRF fund as well.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, Representative Deason, of clarification. You indicated that the fund was frozen in 71, I think.
79.
Did the state start contributing right away after that or later? And when did the city of Minneapolis start contributing, and has it been continuous year after year?
Representative Deason.
Sure. The city of Minneapolis was the employer from, 1908? 1919 to 1979. In 1979, it closed. The state at that, well, the city of Minneapolis then paid in their employer contributions, so the 9.75% for the city, 9.75% for the employees, an additional amount of money, about $4 million, that the city, well, all, and I'm saying city of Minneapolis, I'm referring to all the employers, because these aren't just city of Minneapolis employees, but for shorthand, we'll say that. And then in 1979, anything in excess of that, that was a shortfall, was covered entirely by the state, okay? In 1991, that was capped at, I think, 11 point something million dollars a year. Thank you, yes. And then in 1999, I believe, that was reduced down to $9 million. And then any excess above that that would be a shortfall was to be covered by the employers, so the city of Minneapolis and the other employers. So it's been kind of a shifting thing, but the state has been consistently funding this at different levels since 1979.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I know you weren't here in 1979. You weren't a party.
I was, I think, in sixth grade. Yeah. So, okay.
But he was negotiating.
So you were not a party to that decision. But what I find rather incredible in this situation is that the legislature at the time made that decision and should have known, should have realized that long term this was going to be a problem. I find it incredible that our predecessors didn't understand that there was going to come a day when this thing wasn't going to work, the finances weren't going to work. And I would hope there's a lesson in here for us today, that we better stop thinking about just today and trying to satisfy people's wants and needs today, but what's going to happen down the road? We're still, as we talked about in an earlier hearing, we're still assuming 8.5% return on investments going forward. That's nuts. Absolutely nuts. And we better wake up here, or we're going to be facing more and more of these kinds of problems down the road. There is clearly a problem here that the state has an obligation to fix, in my view. But there better be a lesson for all of us that some bad decisions have been made along the way, and we need to stop making those kinds of decisions.
All right, Representative Kahn.
Well, let me again reiterate that when we looked at every other pension fund, this is the only large fund that is a closed fund. And we look at the contributions, once it was closed, that went into the members that would have kept the fund going, those went into PERA. There are other pension decisions that have been made along the way which probably almost nobody in the legislature knows about. We do a large amount of contributing to volunteer firefighter pension accounts, which we probably have no obligation to contribute to, except we've done it from the fire safety account in terms of doing it. And, you know, I wouldn't want to tell you how much it is over the years. It's like a small amount to each one, but it's a large amount in terms of that. Because this fund was started before Social Security, I think of all the pensioners in Minnesota, these are probably the only ones who are not covered by Social Security. And one of the principles that we've had in terms of refining, and I'm not sure it's totally appropriate for public employees because they make a different kind of contract with it. But one of the pension economists are now saying that the most sensible way to do pensions now, even in a good market as well as in a bad market, is to start with a defined benefit base, which in most cases is Social Security. I doubt if any of the people who are in trouble now with pensions probably do not have Social Security. It's pretty defined coverage all over the country for many things. Then, on top of that, you could do increased pension benefits as a defined contribution instead of a defined benefit. You know, I was here. I wasn't, as all of you know, these decisions are mainly made in the Pension Commission, of which Representative Thiessen and I and Representative Nelson are all members at this time. One of the campaigns I've had, which we've backed up against the Senate again and again, is to add, so that's five members from each body, who probably, if you listen to the debate when pension bills come up, there's very little debate from the rest of the House. One of my campaigns over multiple years has been to just add two more members from each body to the Pension Commission, so that one, there's only one Republican on both sides. One, it would be nice to have another Republican so that there would be two people in your caucus who understood pensions instead of one. And we've bogged down in the Senate. We're missing one vote in the Senate to have that increased input into the Senate thing. I was here when it was capped at 11, and I was here when it was capped, when it was further moved down to 9. Both of those were Senate positions that the House lost. And those were done because the market, you know, because of kind of the fake market assumptions that we've made, and because the market was doing well at that time. But there were, and as I recall, when that cap was put on, the excess money again was distributed mainly, you know, something because I followed the volunteer firefighters issue, it was distributed to pension funds without the state. So it isn't just Minneapolis who has come asking for help in these things. We've given help all over the state in the kind of smaller pieces that people often don't see. But they're very meaningful to the people who got it. And now this is, in terms of the stress and tension that these MRF members who have nothing to fall back on, no Social Security and so forth, you know, it's really important for us to make this fix, which really by doing this separate fund within PERA, but administered by PERA, you know, gives them the kind of confidence that they'll be taken care of, even though making that fund whole will have to happen separately from the rest of it. So I think this is, you know, there are lots of there are good arguments. I find there are good arguments for when we're cutting, when our budget problems are so strong, for not fixing the open funds at this time. Because their problems aren't going to come up for 20 or 30 years, something like that. You know, so I don't mean to say that we don't have to fix them, but I think Representative Thiessen said we're on our way to trying to fix them. I think this is the only one that really needs to be fixed this year. And I think the people who on the Pension Commission who have looked into this and understand all the little pieces of people that are at fault for this problem have understood that this is the one that we've got to do now. So, go.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen and members, yeah, I do want to point out what I think was some circular logic. Representative Thiessen, maybe you can correct me. But you do point out that we have a contractual obligation with these people, and it, you know, if we don't fix this problem, we could end up with lawsuits. Representative Gottwald asked about moving towards why we don't, if we're going to fix this problem, move from a defined benefit to a defined contribution program. And I believe you said that's a secondary issue, it's not part of. And we shouldn't, I think your words were, get bogged down in that. And then you go on to say that there were many concessions given up by the retirees who are going to receive these benefits. So if there were concessions, obviously there were changes in, quote-unquote, the contract. I don't understand why we couldn't have negotiated as part of the changes with the contract, as part of the state getting involved, that part of the negotiations could not have been to move from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. I would think if, as Representative Kahn said, the stress and worry of these members are so great at this point, that that would have been a reasonable part of the negotiations of bringing this bill forward.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The changes that are made in the benefits that the MRF members are switching to is because they're merging into PARA, which have a different benefit set. And so that is the giving up. And I also think you need to think about who these people are. So this is, you know, the average age, and I have it here somewhere, but is 74 years old, right? They're not making contributions anymore. And if you give a lump sum to the folks, because of their age, they're not going to invest it in something that is going to return. It's going to be a very small, you know, if you were to do that, how that would work, right, is you'd take this money, divide it up among all of them, give them a small chunk of money that they could take to their broker and invest. And they are also, they would also have to get, 17, 18, 19% returns just to kind of keep up with where they're going. Again, they don't have Social Security. The model of defined contributions, whether you want to have that discussion and kind of breach, you know, break the contract going forward or break into those rights going forward, that's not what's happening because of the merger. Really, the reason that the benefits are going down for these members or changing is because they're merging into PARA. And so they're going into a different fund with different rules. So it's a little bit of a different situation. And defined contributions just doesn't work for this population anyway. I mean, it's just kind of not... In some sense, I don't think it is a relevant discussion. I think that there's a discussion to be had around that, but I think we need to fix this problem right now going forward.
Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee. A couple of things, points I thought of is one is, you know, we as a state, you know, we cut our planning commission, but we have our local governments have 20-year comprehensive guide plans in counties. So I think we're looking at planning. We need to kind of look at us first to continue to look long range. The other thing is I think now in today's time that 8.5% sounds horrible, but if you go back through probably the last 70 years, the S&P averages about 10.1%. So at the time through the 90s and the 80s, it probably wasn't that unusual of a number where we are right now, but obviously we need to reform those numbers. And then Representative Thiessen, I just had kind of a question on this handout here. I'm not sure what this part is, the DF members is. Can you just explain that part to me?
Representative Thiessen.
I have it here somewhere. Hold on. I have it right here. Okay. Right. This right here. And what do you want me to explain?
Representative Sterner.
Just this bottom part of the 112 members that are on the bottom. That's the only part there.
Oh.
Representative Tease.
That's the deferred members. Mr. Martin, do you want to explain what that means?
Mr. Martin, or who do we need down here?
Or Luther? I think these are members who retired or who left public service before their retirement age. And so they're kind of, they've not, you know, they wouldn't have reached retirement
all right, welcome,
age yet. But Mr. Thompson,
welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Luther Thompson. I'm the part-time executive director at MRF. I've been there about a year. The number you referred to is the members who have not yet retired but have left service and will get an annuity when they reach the retirement age. They're in a deferred status.
Thank you.
Representative Merle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I find myself in agreement in a lot of ways with Representative Lanning. In terms of thinking about hindsight and foresight, and it reminds me, Representative Lanning, of the painting of Prudence, where you have three faces, one looking to the left, one looking to the right, and one looking straight ahead, and you've got a young person looking one direction to the future, you've got an older face looking to the past to learn lessons, and then the middle-aged face looking straight ahead, trying to decide what to do today. This plan was begun in the year of the Black Sox scandal. Looking back on the Black Sox scandal, we hope we learn lessons so we don't have future scandals. I don't put this in the level of a scandal, but certainly I think there were decisions made, Representative Lang, just like you said, that looking back 31 years shouldn't have been made. But I thank Representative Thiessen for having the foresight that we have to act and fix this, because this problem doesn't get better in a year, and it doesn't get better in 5 years. We have to act. I don't know, Representative Condit, I agree with you about the volunteer firefighters and the fire safety account. But I am thankful to you, Representative Thiessen, for mentioning all pensions, because we do have a lot of open plans that need to be addressed, and we heard about that in this committee. And we need to be responsible and take that looking straightforward action to fix these things, because these problems don't go away. And if we don't hear anything from our constituents, I think one message we get is, would you please get the work done? Now, Representative Kahn, I don't think that Minneapolis is asking for help. I think we have a contractual obligation. The legislature, 31 years ago, obliged us to act. We can't change, we can change the benefits in the way that Representative Thiessen said. We can move folks from one plan to another. But when you're 74 years old and you're getting a defined check every month, you're not getting Social Security because this plan started in the same year as the Black Sox scandal, these folks can't be asked to change to a defined contribution plan. I do think we have to have that discussion, Representative Thiessen, for the future and look into what we do on other plans. But this is, as you say, a special situation. So I think it's important that we keep our word. I think it's important that we keep the word of a previous legislature, even if we disagree, and we learn from that lesson moving forward.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, want to basically talk about what Representative Lanning said about mistakes that were made. Yeah, there were miscalculations that were made in the past. Back as early as the 90s, all these pension plans in the states were close to or above 100% funded. And at that time, the legislature voted to lower contribution rates for both the employees and the cities. This fund here, when they closed it and put everybody into para and moved all public employees going forward into para, basically set this one up. And this fund was doing well up until the most recent downturn in the market. I mean, we've made decisions not only in the pensions but also in our state budgets. Back when Jesse Ventura was here, we made choices and we changed tax revenue. And the first year that you and I came into the legislature, we faced a huge deficit because we had made the legislature before us had made big changes in tax rates that affected everybody. And we've been fighting that for the last 8 years. So that's no different than this. We have to look back and, yes, learn from the lessons of the past and remember that if everything looks really rosy now, we have to look forward. While it may not always be that way, and we have to be very cautious in what we're doing. What we're doing here is a cautious approach. If we had done this last year and put this money in last year, say last June when we left the legislature, with the rise in the market that has been the last year, we'd have a smaller problem today than we have right now. When the stock market went from 6,500 in March to 10,000 that it is now, if we had put this money in then, this problem will be smaller that we're looking at. So again, it's something we have to do sooner rather than later. We have to get this done, corrected, so that going forward we don't have a larger problem that we're going to have to face and have to have more money being put in these funds. So I think this is a good bill going forward, and I think we should support this.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think this is a 900-pound gorilla with our demographics of more retirees and fewer workers coming up. We do need to work on this. The specific question I have, Representative Thiessen, are there actual benefit cuts, and if so, what are they to the people in MRF?
Representatives.
The what? Yeah, right. Yeah. So the main change is for retirees, there is in MRF, it is it's a 3.5% CPI up to 3.5%. Okay, so every year it matches inflation cap to 3.5%. In para, that is a 2.5% number. And the bill you'll see in a few weeks here is going to reduce that even further if we pass it as a legislature in para. It'll go down to 1%, 1.5%. So that's the difference. It's in that post-retirement benefit increase every year.
All right. Further discussion? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said before, this is a problem that needs to be fixed. We have an obligation as a state to keep our commitment here. And my point is that we absolutely, as we make these decisions, have to think long term. The worst thing we can do to our successors is to make decisions solely on what seems to be appropriate at the moment. And we better be a whole lot more farsighted. And Representative Nelson, I said before I got here that giving the people money back in the form of rebates was a mistake. It was stupid. Don't we wish that we would have had that?
Yes.
As we faced huge deficits? We've got to start thinking about long-term here more than I think some of our predecessors have done.
All right. Further discussion? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think long-term, and the definition here, especially in retirements, is averaging out over 20, 30 years. So some retirees don't get a great big bump, and others get this smaller bump. And I hear sometimes long-term, but in the definition of retirement, it's even longer than that. And I think also on our state budgeting system, more than 2 years balanced. I think we got to think farther out as well, because there's too many tails that are going forward binding the next legislative session. So I think it's not only for retirement issues. The other thing is that taking the advice of our State Board of Investments. These folks have come to you in the legislature before with recommendations and have not been taken. We are legislative, but I think one of the important things is the ability, especially in this area, to really listen to the State Board of Investments would be a really good thing, and I think that would have helped also in this particular area had they been listened to. So both things, long-term, 20, 30 years, and some of these folks have really good proposals. We should listen to them.
Representative Kahn.
Excuse me, Madam, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiffmeyer, would you give me one example where the legislature didn't take the advice of the State Board of Investment?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn. Back in, I believe it was in the early 2000s or so, and I think that others here can give more specific information, there was at one time when I was on the State Board of Investments as Secretary of State, we had a five-year average of returns. And that was so short that when you have a section of good years, that is what fueled those almost double-digit returns for about 5-6 years in the late 80s and the early 2000s. And the recommendation there at that time was to average spread it out over 20 years and to even do it in a gradual way, but do something. And that was not taken by the legislature, as I understand it.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Except I think it was. Well,
you know, Representative
okay,
Kahn,
that's all
we
right.
could get into reflective history, and certainly right. there have been bills in recent memory before this committee where we've had individuals testify that perhaps we shouldn't have been sending certain messages with the pension fund. And we could go into all of that, and I don't think that's the pertinent message today. The message is the bill that is before us and the hearing that we had the first week of session on the totality of the problem with these plans. And that should be what we are discussing. Not reflective history.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I just didn't want to leave on the note that the legislature has routinely rejected the advice of the State Board of Investment.
Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, as chair of this committee for the brief time I've been chair of it, I'd like to argue that point for a while, but I won't. Representative Cheeson, to your bill, as amended.
I don't have anything further, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate your support.
All right. Representative, do you have anyone else that wishes to testify? Representative Thiessen needs to testify on this one?
No.
All right. Representative Poppy?
I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2922 be recommended to pass as amended to the Finance Committee.
All right. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Members, we're going to have further pension issues before this committee once the Pension Commission is done, and they will be equally interesting. So stay with us. All right, we have one more division report. Representative Nelson.
I'd like to move the House file, get the right number right here, 3109, the
division report.
Division report on House File 3109. Yep.
All right. Representative Nelson moves the division report on House File 3109. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then, Representative Kalin, where is your bill? You want to make the motion on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no state government operations issues in the bill. I move that House File 3109 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance with further recommendation that it be referred to the Energy, Finance, and Policy Division.
All right. To your bill.
Would you like me to
either way, it's fine.
Okay. Mr. Chair, briefly, the House File 3109 is a sets up a voluntary financing option for local units of government for then a voluntary enrollment, adding a special assessment for the property owner, specifically a business or residential property owner, to do energy improvements, primarily energy efficiency, though some qualifying renewable energy systems are available. There's a series of safeguards in the bill to make sure that the program financing works and is a conservative financing program. The third thing that the program does, in addition to special assessments and the financing program, is authorize the sale of industrial revenue bonds by those local units of government. There was no audible dissent in committee, and I think that any energy issues will be worked out with the Energy Committee.
Anyone wish to testify on the questions to the bill? Seeing no questions, Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kalin, it really bothers me to hear the word voluntary when it comes to government stuff, and I have a real concern about that because so often it's the voluntary and then it's a mandate.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, I have no intention, I've never heard any intention of any advocate for the bill to do anything that is mandated at all. It is truly a voluntary program. There will be no enforcement mechanism for anybody to get into the program at all.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kalin, I know that's your intention. I know that's where it's at today, but previous legislatures often take these situations and then convert them later. And so it's like you get this start, and I'm not convinced of its necessity, and I also have concerns about long-term commitments on property owners in regards to the future. And we've seen the real estate and what's happened today unexpectedly and all that, and then you have these binding commitments that go between public private. I just have really deep concerns about this bill and its language and its implications.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, we're working with the realtors and others who are currently supportive in concept and working on getting their support on the detailed mechanisms, and appreciate all the stakeholders working out these issues.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Kalin.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, before you leave, the governor just signed today the early primary bill. We had a number of members who were present. He gave every indication that he would sign the absentee ballot bill that passed out of this committee yesterday, and he also gave every indication that he would sign the administrative bill that we're going to deal with tomorrow. So I would encourage members to be on time and to take these bills seriously. This is not going to be an exercise in just passing legislation to the governor to veto. This is an exercise in passing legislation that's going to become law. With that, Representative Poppy.
I'd like to move the minutes of March 2nd, 2010.
Further discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.